From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, why Texas voters are likely to be hearing a lot of Sharia law fear-mongering, how the Texas abortion ban led to three Texas doctors being disciplined for not providing needed care, and Charles Don Flores sits on Texas death row because of a hypnotized witness. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In Texas, anti-Sharia law politics is going primetime. This is a non-issue. There is no threat of Sharia law being imposed on Texans. It would be impossible to do so, but that's not stopping many of the state's biggest names in Republican politics from claiming that this will happen if they lose the coming election. This is their strategy to win, and so far within the GOP base, it's working. Josh Kovinsky is an investigative reporter for Talking Points Memo. His article is Inside Texas Republicans' Effort to Make the Midterms About Islamophobia.
I think there's been an undercurrent of it for years, but it really kicked into overdrive last year. I think it's important to understand the federal context. You have the Trump administration using its powers to revoke visas in a way that just has never been seen before, of setting these really flimsy, vague national security pretexts to revoke the visas of people like Mahmoud Khalil for pro-Palestine protests. But it's also playing out kind of at the state level across the country. And what you've seen in Texas is Governor Greg Abbott, and along with Attorney General Ken Paxton, stage a number of kind of high-profile instances in which they're using state power to target worship, basically is the Islamic community, but also specifically places of worship. One is EPIC. That's the East Plano Islamic Center. In March of around last year, and so that's just north of Dallas, March of around last year, it's this mosque. They released a video kind of detailing these big expansion plans. And it was going to be a big expansion in a town, the town of Josephine, just outside of the kind of Dallas-Fort Worth area. And the idea was that they were going to build a big mosque there and have a big residential kind of like mixed-use development complex around it. And this immediately blew up. You had politicians up and down the kind of chain of power in Texas accusing this of being a Sharia compound. People were like flooding the Collin County like appraiser meeting at one point. These sort of minor bureaucratic processes got blown up into these big sort of culture war fights. But it did, I think the political establishment in Texas seized on it, saying that, this is an example of these kind of outsiders trying to impose their will on you. That doesn't accord with the facts at all. In reality, it was a mixed-use development. Abbott got the DOJ to do an investigation that lasted around a month or two. And ended when the people who are developing it reaffirmed what was kind of clear from the beginning, which is that there was never a requirement to be Muslim to live in that area, which would violate federal law. But in that case, but it just wasn't part of the plan. And that, has since continued. I mean, Ken Paxton has frozen the development through some lawsuits, but it's also continued on a number of other tracks. The rhetoric around Sharia law has been kept up at a really high pace. I think, as you mentioned earlier, David, in the GOP primary, there was a ballot proposal, a proposition to ban Sharia law. Other states have done that. But, that was on the GOP primary ballot in Texas. It's not clear what that would mean. And at the same time, you've also seen kind of it manifest in a few other ways. So a couple weeks ago, for example, Ken Paxton, did a legal action against something called the Islamic Tribunal. It's based in Dallas. What it really is just like a private body where if you have a question, if you're Muslim and you have a question about something to do with Islam, you can go to them and they'll adjudicate it for you. But he went after it as if this was like a Sharia court that had been set up to, do whatever they think it's going to do. So I think what you've like seen, at least until now, is two things just broadly to sum up. You've seen the kind of politicians like Abbott and Paxton use the levers of state power to really go after the Muslim community in Texas. And the other way that I failed to mention that was really important is Ken Paxton and Greg Abbott accusing CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, of being a foreign terrorist organization. That's also playing out in the courts. But the other way you see it play out is just in terms of the rhetoric. And that has mostly been through the primary season, but we're now starting to see it, I think, bleed into the midterms.
So it looks like the Republican Party of Texas, including Governor Greg Abbott, is creating a straw man of Sharia law in Texas, and we need to vote Republican in the midterms in order to prevent Sharia law from coming to Texas. And that we've seen the rhetoric, we've seen campaign ads already. This is something that we've seen in the primary runoff race between Ken Paxton and Senator John Cornyn, accusing each other of allowing Sharia law to come in. This seems to be the area that they want to cultivate. Past elections, we've seen them talk about the transgender phobia and anti-illegal immigration. We're under an invasion. When you have a politics of fear, you have to come up with something for people to be afraid of. Is this the next big thing?
It certainly seems to be one of the next big things. And I think what's important to note is that this really does resonate with the base. You know, I was in Dallas last week, and I went to meet some people who were going on a bus to go to Austin to protest what they saw as the inclusion of Sharia law in a draft of the state social studies curriculum. And everybody I met there, I mean, they sincerely believed that, and I'm really talking about the rank and file, not the higher ups. They sincerely believed that this is a threat, and they wanted to protect what they saw as a Christian vision of their state and of their country. And they were ready to go and wake up at 3 a.m. to go to a bus, miles away at 5 a.m. to be in Dallas, to be in Austin at 10 a.m. To do that. And so I think that is the value for the people kind of higher up in the party who recognize, you know, who are, I think, for what it's worth, in touch with reality. They understand that Sharia law is not a problem. They understand that it's a straw man. They understand that, as you say, it's a way you can scare people. But they're willing to do it because it does mobilize people. And I think it also ties into current events. I mean, after October 7th in Israel, this became, I think, a national issue. And also because of the Iran war, there's just a lot of ways that you can kind of distract people and have them focus and basically present Islam to them as some kind of foreign threat. You know, I spoke with a Republican political consultant. His name is Vinny Minchillo. And he has worked for a long time in the Dallas area on Republican political campaigns. And what he said to me explicitly is, if you're a Republican politician right now and you're trying to defend your seat or claim a new one, you are facing a lot of headwinds because of affordability. Prices have gone up because of the war in Iran. That's expected to only continue, at least for the near future. And so a great way to distract people from that is to try to scare them. And the way they're trying to do that is by talking about Islam.
Is there any evidence that any Texas Muslim group is actually trying to exercise cohesive legal authority at all over anyone?
No, there's no evidence of that. And I would just note that when you go and try to talk to these Muslim groups, they make a real point of showing how open they are. I mean, they're quite welcoming. And I think that's partly, you know, again, as I said, they're making a show of that. They're trying to demonstrate that they don't have a cohesive plan to impose some kind of religious law on everybody around them. They're trying to demonstrate that they're just neighbors. But yeah, to answer your question, there's no evidence that there's any kind of.
Is there any kind of way that Sharia law could be imposed on Texas, especially given that Muslims, 3% of the state's population?
No, there's no way. I mean, I think, but I would analogize it to there are private moral beliefs that people have that come from their faith. And there are many countries in the world where those same beliefs that are tied to their faith also inform laws of those countries. But, you know, that's just not where we are with Sharia law, which, as it exists in the United States and Texas as well, is just a kind of private moral code for people who identify as Muslim.
Muslims are not using Sharia law to put things like the Ten Commandments in classrooms, or not trying to force children in classrooms to read a holy book as part of their curriculum. They don't require the saying of a Muslim prayer at the start of a school day. That would be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, nobody has to put their hand on the Quran to do anything. It's true.
But we're doing it with the Christian faith.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's definitely, look, I think if you talk to a lot of people who are involved in this, one thing you'll find is that there is a kind of mirroring going on where the evangelical community, you know, in Texas and across the country for the longest time has, I think it's fair to say, tried to impose their beliefs on the world around them. You mentioned, you know, putting having 10 commandments displayed in schools. From the federal level, the Supreme Court down to state laws, we see a lot of legislation that's just explicitly influenced by and cites to scripture. I think it was a couple of years ago, the Alabama Supreme Court barred IVF by citing scripture. I think we can see that across the country. And sometimes when you talk to these activists, it's almost like they are on some level aware that, you know, we are doing this thing. We have our faith and we would like to kind of reshape the world around us in the image of that faith. And it's almost like that's driving their fear that that's what Muslims intend to do. It's like in some level, it's an admission.
Josh Kovinsky is an investigative reporter for Talking Points Memo. His article is Inside Texas Republicans' Effort to Make the Midterms About Islamophobia. The Texas strict abortion ban has raised repeated questions about what happens when pregnant patients face medical emergencies and whether doctors are delaying life-saving care out of fear of violating the law. A new ProPublica story reports that the Texas Medical Board has disciplined three doctors connected to the deaths of two women who did not receive timely or appropriate treatment during pregnancy complications. ProPublica's Kavita Serrana investigates the problem and has written the story, Texas Medical Board Sanctions Three Doctors for Delayed Care That Led to the Deaths of Two Pregnant Women.
Two of the doctors were found not to have properly treated a pregnant teenager who repeatedly went to emergency rooms trying to get help for a life-threatening infection. The third did not provide a dilation and curettage, known as a DNC, a procedure to empty the uterus, to a patient who was miscarrying and bleeding to death. And the board found that in all these cases that the delays in care led to the patient's deaths.
What these doctors did or didn't do, was that any way related to the fact that Texas now has an anti-abortion law that if a doctor is found to have violated it, they could lose their license and they could have life in prison?
Yeah, these actions are significant because ever since Texas's abortion bans went into effect, delays in care for pregnant and miscarrying women have been a big topic. And this isn't about people going to have an abortion for an unwanted pregnancy, sometimes not even about an abortion, but even people who are simply pregnant, they need medical help, or maybe they're miscarrying, being told that they are, being turned away from hospitals without proper care or told that they have to wait to get sicker. There's been 20 women who sued the state saying they were denied necessary care because of the state's abortion ban. And we at ProPublica have investigated many cases of women who didn't receive the right treatments during miscarriages, including four women who died. We've also reviewed data that shows that sepsis rates and blood transfusion rates at hospitals spiked for miscarrying women after the ban went into effect, which are strong signs of an increase in delayed care. And the doctors we speak with, we've spoken to dozens around the state, more than 100 across the country with states with similar laws. They say that these criminal laws have a really profound impact on the relationship between doctors and their patients. And in many cases, the hospital is no longer just pressing the doctor to think about the best way to treat your complication when you come in. They're also looking over their shoulder at criminal liability, like the penalties that you just mentioned and the law in Texas are extremely high, and how to protect themselves. So to see the board take action in a few of these cases, it might start to send a statement because this is the first time we're seeing some public accountability for some of the doctors involved in these cases.
So this is not a story about individual medical mistakes. This is about how the Texas abortion ban may have reshaped emergency pregnancy care for the worse.
I think that fits into the larger context as I was describing. These particular cases, you know, they don't make a statement about abortion. And I think for people who, you know, are watching this and care about women's health care in the state, that's something that they point out, that there's many other cases that have been publicly reported of doctors who specifically did not provide an abortion during an emergency or high risk situation, citing the law, and then the patient suffered a severe injury or died, like Amanda Zurowski, Joseli Barnica, or Tierra Walker. And that's even after the Supreme Court said that doctors should be providing that care under the law's exception. So I think that if we saw the board come out with a discipline on cases like that, it would be even more impactful. In these cases, we don't know what's inside the doctor's head. We were just able to report the facts of what happened in the case, and that it is significant that the board agreed that this is not standard care.
Right. So, but the Texas Medical Board as actually disciplines these doctors, it does seem to be trying to provide some sort of corrective measure to the fear of providing, of not providing care for women in need.
I think that's what some people hoped. Since the beginning of these laws, there have been calls for the medical board to take a more public stance on upholding professional standards, making sure that doctors are not confused, and continue providing pregnant women with all their options and the best care possible. But under the shadow of an extremely punitive law, for a while, the board has essentially, they threw up their hands. They said that they were confused too, that they're not lawmakers. They couldn't predict what a prosecutor would do. They could only investigate cases on the back end and make judgments. So, this left things in a really uncertain position. And so I think this is, malpractice cases, while there are some that are open and are ongoing, in the meantime, to see the board take a step like this on even some cases, I think people are seen as significant. Of course, reproductive health advocates, they also think that this was too little, too late, and is actually quite quiet. People aren't really aware of this until reporters like us notice it and bring it to the public's attention. So how much impact does that really have is still an open question.
How unusual is it that the Texas Medical Board did this discipline for these three doctors?
Well, a lawyer representing the families of these two women, she said she represents malpractice cases like this all the time, and in her view, it's very rare that she sees the board release discipline, especially while litigation is still open. So for her, she thought this was a signal.
And the board, they could have gone a lot further in the discipline, but they just, is this a slap on the wrist?
Each doctor was ordered to take 8 hours of continuing education training courses and inform all employers of the judgment. We spoke with the husband of one of the women, Hope Gumazi, who felt this really wasn't enough. He wished the board had used its power to suspend or revoke the doctor's license. And a lot of people have also compared this kind of punishment to the punishment that you can get for illegally providing an abortion, which is a felony. The law threatens up to 99 years in prison and huge fines. But as I said, the lawyer representing these families, she saw it somewhat differently, that even to come out with an action while there's ongoing malpractice cases to essentially corroborate some of the claims that she's making was significant.
I mean, so a doctor who is presented with a case similar to the ones here will have to do some form of calculus and saying, on one hand, if I perform this necessary care, I could end up with my license taken away or in a lifetime in prison, or I could be ordered by the Texas Medical Board to take additional training. Which would you choose?
I think that's what some of the critics point out, that the law is still going to affect the care that patients get as long as there's such a punitive law and confusion about it.
Kavitha Serrana is a reporter for ProPublica. Her story is Texas Medical Board sanctions three doctors for delayed care that led to the deaths of two pregnant women. Can a witness's hypnotized testimony be used to convict someone of murder and then send them to death row? In the latest season of the podcast series, The Unforgotten, Texas Observer staff writer Michelle Pitcher investigates the case of Charles Don Flores.
Charles Flores sits on death row. He doesn't right now have an execution date set. So, perhaps there's not as much urgency as there is for some of the folks who do have an execution date set. But his case has been really remarkable for, the lifetime of it, really. So back in 1998, he was arrested. He was put on trial the following year, and he was identified in court by an eyewitness who had initially described someone completely different. And then she had undergone what was called investigative hypnosis. She had seen his photo in the news. And after months and months of not being able to identify him as the person that she saw related to this crime, she ID'd him in court. And I spoke with a juror who was in the room, and he told me that that identification really played a huge role in their decision to convict and sentence to death. So all of that has been reported. I know you've reported on the hypnosis angle, and the courts have actually taken a look at it too. And the appeals have been going in earnest for a decade now, and still there's been no real movement. So there are several things that are concerning with this case when you look at the details and how the conviction was reached. And what we keep seeing from the courts again and again is just denial after denial. And I thought it was important that the public understands what goes on behind the scenes when, you know, all they're hearing from courts is just like blanket no when we're talking about appeals in cases like this.
So I have met Charles Don Flores on death row, and I interviewed him, and he is quite the storyteller. Gregarious, big figure, and he has a lot of stories to tell. There, you could just sit and talk. It's like talking to someone at a bar. He's just telling you these incredible stories about. But he was someone who was involved in selling drugs in Farmers Branch, Texas. He will tell you that. He admits to that. But he will say, you know, and there's no evidence to support the claim that he participated in the murder of Betty Black. And they do know who actually was there, who drove this crazy-looking VW bug, and that was Rick Childs. And yet he is not in prison. He is not on death row. So, I mean, that is just one of the big questions in this case is, why did they let the person who they know actually who admitted to being the killer go?
Right. And I think that that's something that bothers a lot of people about Texas law in general. So like you mentioned, this case involves two men who drove up to a woman's house, Betty Black's house in Farmers Branch early one morning. Broke in through the garage, and one of the men shot and killed Betty Black. One of the men was immediately identified. That was Rick Childs. He was the owner of this psychedelic VW bug that was very recognizable. And then they were trying to identify the passenger, this other guy, and that is who a witness would later at trial say was Charles Flores. But at the time, she was describing someone completely different, someone who looked a lot like Rick Childs, who was, you know, a white guy, medium build, long hair. And Charles Flores is an overweight Hispanic man with a buzz cut and glasses. So the descriptions were always kind of at issue. But in terms of Rick Childs, he would later sign a judicial confession admitting to shooting and killing Betty Black. And in doing so, he got a plea deal. So he was not sentenced to death, obviously. He was sentenced to just a term of years. He served a portion of that and then was let out on parole 10 years ago. So back in 2016, around the same time that Charles Flores was facing an execution date.
Is there a racial component to this? Rick Childs being Anglo, Charles Don Flores being Mexican-American?
That's certainly brought up a lot in the appeals. And I spoke with the original trial prosecutor, Jason January, who would have had a lot to do with the deal-making in the DA's office at the time, being the lead of the case. And he was explaining it to me. He denied that there was any racial component and was explaining this thing called the law of parties, which is in Texas, if two or more people are committing some sort of crime, say a robbery, a burglary, and one of them kills someone in the process, everyone in the group can be legally culpable of that murder if there was like a reasonable understanding that someone could have died in the process of committing this crime. So Charles was tried under the law of parties. So it wasn't even important that he was the shooter. He could still be charged with capital murder, convicted of capital murder, if he was there and could have anticipated that the situation could turn deadly.
That's true, but it doesn't explain the discrepancy, because the person who is Mexican-American is on death row, and the white person who was definitely there, who was the driver, who confessed to the whole thing, really didn't get a whole lot of accountability.
Yeah, exactly. And what Jason was saying, Jason January was saying, was that in these law of parties cases, it often comes down to who cooperates first. And it's a really hard pill to swallow, because there is this, you know, glaring difference between these two defendants. We find out later through one of Charles Flores's appeals attorney that Rick Childs, the white man, was the son of a police officer as well. So it's hard to imagine that back in Farmers Branch in Dallas County, 1999, that it was just a completely like race blind situation all around. I think it would be naive to ignore that there is a racial disparity. But while Charles Flores's attorneys are really highlighting it, the state has really tried to deny those claims.
But really, the case hinges on this hypnotized witness, Jill Barguenier. And this is now before the Supreme Court. February of this year, they have filed a petition with the Supreme Court. And so far, that petition is still pending. If someone can be put to death based on the testimony of someone who was hypnotized.
Right. And in Texas, it's no longer allowed to admit hypnotized witness testimony in a criminal case. So in 2023, the law changed, but it wasn't retroactive. So the hypnotized witness has been a huge part of the appeals so far. There have been questions about the validity of the science, the suggestibility, like you mentioned.
It's just not reliable.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that is the crux of what the most promising appeal was trying to really break down the idea that hypnosis in any form could be used as a reliable memory retrieval device. That's just not true.
Especially when someone's life is on the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it also speaks to some greater problems with witness testimony in general. Eyewitness testimony is pretty unreliable and has led to a lot of wrongful convictions in the U.S. over the past decades.
Michelle Pitcher is a staff writer at the Texas Observer covering criminal justice. She investigates the death row case of Charles Don Flores in the podcast The Unforgotten Writing Shotgun. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find past episodes of Texas Matters at tpr.org and download and subscribe to us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.